Welcome back to Rabbiting On. We're back after a little break, ready to go after the intensely busy time over the High Holy Days. I'm Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, and sadly Rabbi Robin isn't able to join us today, but I'm here with Rabbi Miriam Berger, and we are both so thrilled to be joined today all the way from Washington DC in the US by Yolanda Savage Nava, who is the Director of Racial Equity, Diversity and Inclusion at our sister movement over in the US, the Union of Reformed Judaism. How is everyone, and how on earth do you fit that job title onto a card, Yolanda?
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's quite a mouthful, isn't it? Well, luckily, racial equity, diversity, and inclusion has a catchy acronym that says READY. And so usually I just say I'm the director of READY, and people say, oh, are you ready for READY? And they have all kinds of jokes to go along with it. But the acronym is really interesting because it captures so much of the work that we're trying to do for really looking at creating these systems of belonging. So we're looking at the equity piece around race and people from marginalized identities, the diversity of our movement, and then inclusion, making sure that everyone feels a sense of belonging and community in our movement. So Ready is a great title.
That is a great title. And Miriam, how are you doing this week?
I am all good, thank you. It feels good to be at a time where we only have one Shabbat a week now, and life is getting back to normal. It's great.
It is. So the British Board of Deputies commissioned a landmark report, which was chaired by Stephen Bush and looked at racial inclusivity back in April 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by Derek Chauvin. Following that, at our last AGM for the Movement for Reformed Judaism back in June, we passed a resolution on racial inclusivity and have since also published a report of our recommendations that communities and individuals can help take on in order to bolster racial inclusivity. So I think, you know, that sense of we know there's something that needs to be done, we know there's a problem, and we're taking steps really to address it, but sort of, for me personally, passing motions and writing reports can't be the end of where we are and what we do. So I would really just love to hear, to start off with, from Yolanda a little bit about this incredible program with the amazing name of READY. But also, we've used the phrase quite a lot in the UK that's come from URJ, this term audacious hospitality. And I actually think we've been misusing it quite a lot. I think we've used it to mean we want to welcome everyone, we want to be inclusive of everyone, we want to make sure that we're reaching out. But actually, I think it's probably been a lot more specific in its origins from the URJ. So could you explain to us a little bit about the background of the program and how it's working on the ground for you?
Of course. So first of all, you mentioned that you have proposed a resolution and you are making some steps to really kind of cement the work that you would like to do. And I just want to acknowledge that that's a part of it. It's a process. It's the beginning of really kind of putting a stake in the ground and understanding what the issues are. And so that's a piece of the journey of this work. And so I just wanted to make sure that I acknowledge that, because that's an important piece of it. So the word audacious hospitality, I think, can be used in many contexts. For the Union for Reform Judaism, actually, the president, Rabbi Rick Jacobs, thought of the term, I think maybe in 2014, I'm not quite sure on the date. And audacious hospitality was really created to think about this transformative spiritual practice that was rooted in equity and justice. And so it was really meant to make sure that people were bold and intentional about the work that they were doing around racial equity, diversity, and inclusion. And then the hospitality piece is doing it in a way where we're bringing people in, we're calling people in, as opposed to calling them out. And so while we are making sure people understand the importance of this work, there's a way to do it that really embraces our Judaism, embraces our values, and embraces meeting people where they are on their journey. And so that's really how we view the term audacious hospitality.
It's fascinating kind of timing for me to be having this conversation today. I accompanied a candidate to the Beit Din this afternoon, and we were having a conversation and a chat while he was nervously waiting for his appointment. And he said, you know, one of the things that he struggles with most is walking into Jewish environments and being met with kind of suspicion. That moment of, I'm welcoming you and I'm being hospitable, but I'm doing it in a way that assumes you're not Jewish. And, you know, I think there's so much of that kind of small Jewish mindset of, let's have these conversations and, you know, let's find out who we know in common. And that piece that it, you know, that can be so welcoming and can be so hospitable. And yet, when you're treated as the person that is other, when you feel so much part of the community, it must be a devastating kind of double whammy of what it means to feel not included.
You know, Rabbi Miriam, it's a huge challenge. And it's one that I think our Jewish community has to tackle, because our community is diverse, and there is no real, you know, quote unquote, way that a person looks Jewish. People have multiple backgrounds and intersectional identities that they bring to being Jewish. And I think it's really important for people to understand their own implicit biases around who is Jewish, what does Jewish look like, and understand that the Jewish people have a variety of backgrounds and identities that make us beautiful and make us who we are. And every single time someone doesn't have the look of being Jewish walks into a synagogue or a communal space and he, she, or they feel unwelcomed, that's a part of our community that we're excluding. And that's a part of the community that doesn't have the opportunity to give and present who they are and their full, whole selves in that space. And that's a part of the work that we're trying to do at the URJ and through our Ready Lens, is to really create this movement from welcoming the stranger, because I think that's the mindset. It's like, oh, this person doesn't look like they're part of the Jewish community, so we're going to welcome the stranger to belonging, and saying every person that walks into my community belongs here, and addressing that person and approaching that person as if they do actually belong in that space.
Right. It's fascinating, that idea of, we're pretty good, I reckon, at welcoming the stranger. The challenge is when somebody is assumed to be the stranger, when actually they're not, they're part of the community. And that offense that is so easy to cause and so devastating for someone when they feel constantly pushed away.
And I think we all heard those stories if we were listening last year, right? It suddenly people from all kinds of backgrounds felt able to tell us those stories. And I know it involved a huge amount of emotional labor to do that, but I was so grateful in our own community and also so horrified. I think most of us were horrified to hear those stories from within our communities. None of us are living in sort of perfect bubbles where this isn't our problem. This is something that is happening across the Jewish community, and you know, how we start to shift that is the work in front of us, really. Do you have a kind of top tip of a starting point of how we start to create the change that is currently needed?
It's an excellent question. And I think a lot of people kind of turn to the external forces, the work that happens in communities or in groups. And a big part of it, I want that work to continue. That's a huge part of the work that we have to do, make sure that we're doing kind of the external work. But the internal work is usually the harder work. And I often use the term mirrors and windows, for example. So if you think about a mirror, you're holding this mirror up and you're looking at it and you're saying, how do I address the biases, the racism, and the other oppressive ideas that I have about other communities. How do I address that and continue to do that on a daily basis in order to make sure that when I come to a collective sense of community, that I am able to be an ally. I am able to disrupt a microaggression if I see it. I'm able to have this sense of awareness that will help the other people in that community understand the work that they also need to do. And so I would say one of the things that is most accessible to do is the internal work, but also probably the most challenging is to really have to look at yourself and figure out or acknowledge that there are things that have been planted in us based on the societies that we live in. And how do we grapple with those things and make sure that we acknowledge that they're there and continue to address them over and over? I want to quote a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist by Dr. Ibram Kendi. I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but one of the things Dr. Kendi talks about in the book is that everyone is working on the path or on the path to becoming an anti-racist, that we actually never get there because every time we're in a situation, we're faced with the decision of to be anti-racist or racist. And some people really push back on that because they say, well, what about this not racist category? Like you're saying, to be either you're racist or you're anti-racist. How about I'm just not racist? And so when you kind of hover in that gray area around not being racist, that means you're playing a passive role and that doesn't allow you to actively be anti-racist. And so we're all constantly, and that's every single one of us because of the cultures that we have been raised in, we're actively making choices to be anti-racist. Not racist is a passive place that basically puts you in the racist category if you're not actively working to prevent a racist act.
And so many of us who don't even know that we're being racist because we don't intend to, but there's a conditioning that we've kind of lived with or an environment that we've grown up in, which has taught us to make assumptions which are perceived by other people to be incredibly hurtful and are therefore racist. I had this awful conversation with a kid. So we have this crazy system in this country where if you want to go to a Jewish school, which is funded by the state, you have to classify yourself as Jewish. And how can you classify yourself as Jewish? You end up getting synagogue points by attending services. Don't go there. It's not a system anyone else would want to replicate.
It's an episode for another time.
Yeah. But what it means is that as a rabbi in a synagogue with many Jewish schools locally, I find myself signing a lot of these forms for kids who have either members or not members who have fulfilled the requirement of coming to synagogue a number of times. And I sat with a kid who was there with his mum with me signing the form. And I said something about, oh, you know, what makes you want to go to this school? And he said, I don't. I don't want to go there at all. My mum wants me to go there. And I was like, okay. And what makes you not want to go there? And he said, look at my face. I walked around the school on the open day and I didn't see a single person that looked like me. Would you want to be the only black kid in school? And I was just like, okay, like I totally understand that. And I understood his, you know, anxiety around not wanting to be dropped into a space where he was the only Jewish kid that looked a certain way and that what would people assume about him and his Jewish status. But also I then realized what that meant for all those white Jewish kids in that school of never being able to see that actually their school also looked diverse, even in a Jewish environment, and therefore plays into that same conditioning that when they arrive in a Jewish environment, they assume everybody will look like them or at least, you know, have white skin.
Right. And I think that you bring up a very interesting point because I know often we kind of skew to, you know, what happens with adults, but what's happening in our schools, our Jewish day schools, and oftentimes most of the environment are Jews with white skin. And if we're talking about starting with the younger generation, and there's this mindset that this is who is Jewish, when they do have an opportunity to be in community with multiracial, multiethnic Jews, people from all different backgrounds, it causes a lot of tension because it hasn't been something that they've had an opportunity to actually grow up with. And it's a normal part of the Jewish community to have people who don't all look the same, but with one but still with this common piece of being Jewish and embracing that. And it's a challenge, and it's not just in one place. I think this is a challenge that we're facing globally.
So in terms of, I think that the school conversation is a really fascinating one that I really do think there is another episode in, because actually the situation we find ourselves in here in the UK is that a lot of Jewish parents now don't want to send their kids to non-Jewish schools because so many Jews are in the Jewish schools that you end up being the only Jew in the other schools, just right. Like this kid was worried about being the only Black Jewish kid. And these sort of mix of identities and the stress of, we've created in some ways societies where we don't know how to interact with difference in a lot of ways. And we're sort of, I think we see it on social media all the time, the stress of discomfort when faced with someone who might disagree with us or be different to us or take a different approach, regardless of what the outside looks like. You know, we can't even cope with the different opinions a lot of the time. And I think that inability to struggle appropriately is really challenging and is a huge piece of work that we need to do as communities. But we know from the reports that we've had from the Board of Deputies that there are really kind of key areas of challenge for us as a community, from like underrepresented groups within the Jewish world, not just Black Jews, but also Mizrahi Jews who feel like they walk into very Ashkenormative spaces all the time. And, you know, what happens to people who try to explain their experiences and, you know, whistleblowing and those kind of things, as well as the challenge of dealing with our own history and textual tradition, where, you know, I don't know about any other rabbis, but it happened about a week after the Black Lives Matter protests really sort of took off in London. We hit the parasha where Miriam develops leprosy and is, you know, in the rabbinic tradition is basically sometimes described as that's her punishment for speaking Lashon Hara, or basically racist speech against Moses' wife. And I certainly used that in my sermon as a hook to open up the conversation. But we don't have a lot of texts that are positive approaches to racial diversity within Judaism. We have a lot of war texts, and we have a lot of really stressful texts. So I suppose there's a question of what are the things that we can actually do as a community to start really tackling the challenges that we face. How do we help people speak up? And how do we help people hear that difference and hear that there's a problem and change their behaviors so that we are a space of welcome and a space of audacious hospitality?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, first off, that was my son's bar mitzvah portion. So I know when you mentioned it, it started all flooding back. I mean, I've heard so much about this, and he's written a speech about it and what have you. So it's a really powerful portion to really help dive into some of the challenges around around racism. And I think you're right. We have a lot of texts that sometimes has a lot of misogyny and racism and some of those things in it. And I think it's important for us to point those things out and have conversations around them. So that's one piece. So some steps to take to really addressing the issues that we face. I think the first thing is to acknowledge that they're there, to acknowledge that, unfortunately, I as an individual play a role in the systems of oppression because of possibly how I've benefited from privilege, and then using that as an opportunity to do something, using that as a place of allyship to be able to really move the needle in the direction that you want to go. I think that's the first piece. I think the second piece is really understanding that this is a journey, and that on that journey, we will run into barriers. We will mess up sometimes. We're going to say the wrong things, and we're going to have periods of time where we will be uncomfortable. And that's a part of the growth and evolution of this process. That's the piece that is actually needed in order to grow and to continue on the path to becoming an anti-racist. So not beating ourselves up every time we say something that we shouldn't say. You know, this whole thing, I think, around this cancel culture mentality, I say, let's think about compassion culture. We're all here trying to learn and grow together, and keeping that in mind is really important. And I think the third piece is tapping into the work externally. Like, there's a role for that, and creating opportunities for people to learn and grow. If you are in a synagogue, really, the URJ has some awesome resources that synagogues could use to actually look at where they are with their DEI work. We call it the congregational assessment, where you can walk through, you can form a small committee of lay leaders and staff to help you determine where some of the challenges are and some of the things that you can actually change. Use that opportunity to create a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee within your synagogue. And then that's the group that is continuously planning and providing trainings and workshops for the community, offering opportunities to bring speakers in, continuing, I think, to kind of build that stamina around the education piece that's really important.
Say, we're going to link to those resources that the URJ has on our show notes. And there's also training and resources that Reform Judaism in the UK offers. If you get in touch with us, we'll put the details on, but we can share how people can get involved in that. But I think I love that phrase, compassion culture. I might steal that Bashem Monroe. I'm going to teach it in your honor. But I think that's such a beautiful reframing of how we can approach each other.
Yeah. I think so too. And I think that finally, I will say that it's important to understand that above all, we have the connection to humanity. We have that common connection to humanity. And we are all working to try to make the world a better place. And I think if we approach this work in that way, that we will sometimes stumble and experience discomfort or be uncomfortable, but it's okay. It's part of the process. We're human, and we have to keep pushing forward and moving forward together.
I think when we're such a tiny percent of the population and have spent so much of our history, and sadly we spend, you know, so much of the current time kind of exposing anti-Semitism and experiencing anti-Semitism and kind of responding to anti-Semitism, the idea that actually there's so much racism at the core of our own communities as well, that we need to be able to, you know, do exactly what you said, hold that mirror up and say, what does this look like in terms of how we are interacting in the world and in our own communities? And how can we treat each other with that compassion to make mistakes and to make assumptions and to be able to say, I acknowledge that that's what I've done. How do I now create a different understanding and a sense of openness and welcoming and the communities that we want to be? I think that the horrifying idea for me is that we sort of, you know, October is Black History Month, and it's so easy to kind of find these hooks and have a conversation and leave them at the conversation. And almost, I think sometimes that's worse than not having had the conversation at all. They're like, oh, I can use this as a soundbite and I can show I care, but actually it doesn't go anywhere and it doesn't change anything. And it's such a long process. It's so hard to change ingrained culture because it's not really just a set of rules. it's so much deeper than that. It's so much harder than that. I think there's like almost a call out also of not just people feeling that they can share their pain, which I think was really helpful when members of the community were able to say, this is how I have been bruised and hurt by the community, but also saying, well, what about me? You know, what about Ashkenazi and Sephardi? What about Ethiopian Jews? All these different heritages, what, you know, Indian Jews, let's share the customs and share the cultures and make our synagogues a place where we understand the kind of melting pot of all of these different traditions. But often our rabbis don't demonstrate much diversity within their own mold, although Debbie and Robin and I share a great diversity of all sorts of things apart from our age and gender and, you know, all sorts of things like that. But if we did. But I think that's almost a call then to the listeners, to our communities, to be able to say, well, actually, what about my history? Let this be part of who I am. You know, the story of Jews from Arab countries. You know, let's start weaving together those narratives in a more beautiful way and in a more homogeneous way.
I love that. And I would just add a challenge to the end of our conversation, and it's to get proximate. We have to be able to be in relationship with people who appear to be different from us. And until we really make that a goal, it's really a lot of what you said, Rabbi Miriam, and in London, October is Black History Month, and there's a focus on that. And then what happens in November and December and April and the rest of the time? And if we are really consciously building relationships and communities that are expanding beyond who we usually reach out to, then that's where we start to really embrace the diversity of who we are, and it just becomes a part of what we do. And so I think that we have to be deliberate and intentional about doing that.
So we want to say a huge, huge thank you to Yolanda. Thank you so much for joining us. And we know that you're massively in demand. So we really appreciate the time that you've taken to just be with us. And we also want to say that if you are out there listening and you have a heritage that you feel is underrepresented, we really, really want to hear from you. We know that it's important that lots of different voices are heard, and we've been conscious since the start of Rabbiting On that Miriam and Robin and I are not a diverse bunch of women, and we're all sort of the same age, sort of have the same age kids, and you know, we come from a certain, you know, we're diverse because Robin's from Manchester, that's about as far as it goes. But, you know, we really love hearing from our listeners, and everyone is welcome to get in touch. And we love being able to interact with you. So you can drop us a line at media@rjuk.org or on Twitter or Facebook or all the other ways. Also to mention that there's an interview between Rabbi Mark Goldsmith and the chair of the report on interracial inclusivity that Stephen Bush wrote. So Stephen Bush and Rabbi Mark Goldsmith chatting about the report can be found on the Reform Judaism channel on YouTube. So do check that out if you want to know more. But that's it for this episode. We're going to be back in a couple of weeks as usual to talk about why we're obliged as Jews to take care of our planet as COP26 gets going in Glasgow. So we hope you will join us for that. Once again, a huge thanks to Yolanda, and let the learning and the compassion culture continue.
I love it. A pleasure being with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for teaching us so much.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye. Rabbit.